Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife remastered episode, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. I've recently gone back and listened to some of the older episodes, and I was reminded just how much valuable, relevant insight they still offer. So I'm going to be re-releasing one episode each week, now with updated and remastered audio for a much better listening experience. In this episode, I'm talking to Walter Simkew. Walter is the author of the book Born Again. Walter has presented at the Society for Scientific Exploration, an academic group that pioneer reincarnation researcher Ian Stevenson co-founded. Dr. Simkew has been a speaker at the first four world congresses for regression therapy held in the Netherlands, India, Brazil and Turkey. He has appeared on CNN and in Newsweek, as well as numerous other television and radio shows, including Coast to Coast. Hello, Walter, and thank you very much for giving us your time and coming onto the podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for the opportunity.
Now, you run the Reincarnation Research website.
Correct.
Can you give us an overview of that?
Yeah, so one of the main focuses of the website is to disseminate objective evidence of reincarnation, and in particular, the work of Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, who for 40 years traveled all around the world studying young children who had spontaneous past life memories that could be objectively validated. And there's a huge amount of evidence that proves that reincarnation research exists, but most people don't have access to it. One reason is that Ian Stevenson was an academic psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, and he wrote for other academics. And he really wanted to bring reincarnation research into the scientific realm. And because of that, the way he wrote was like a lawyer presenting evidence to a jury. And he would write cases up where he would even use tables to tell the story or describe the case, where he would have the child's statement statements in the rows of a table, and then in the columns, he would specify which witness corroborated the child's statements. Usually the witness was somebody from the child's past life family who could verify the child's memories. And so from a evidentiary point of view, he did a phenomenal job. But the way he did it, it makes the reading very difficult. And so what I've been doing is I've been rewriting his cases. And at the University of Virginia, they actually have more than 1,500 of these childhood past life memory cases where the child's past life memories were objectively validated. And I'm rewriting his cases in easy to understand story form, yet staying faithful to the evidence that Stevenson had gathered. And I do it in a story form. And I also use pictures, you know, to make it like a storybook so that everybody has access to his work. One of the primary reasons I think this is so important is that the reincarnation cases show that you can change religion, nationality, and ethnic affiliation from one lifetime to another. And when people realize this, it will help make the world more peaceful, because most conflicts and wars are based on differences and these cultural markers of identity. So one person maybe Jewish in Israel, and they want to defend their heritage. And the Palestinians, who are Muslim, want to protect their heritage, and they fight each other. Or like in the Crusades, where the Christians wanted to take over Jerusalem. So we've had all these wars and conflicts based on differences in religion as well as nationality. But when people realize these can change from lifetime to lifetime, that a Jewish person can reincarnate as a Muslim and vice versa, that a Muslim can reincarnate as a Hindu and vice versa, then people will stop fighting about this. So I really see that this evidence of reincarnation is going to transform the world in a very major way. And I use the analogy how, you know, the American Revolution took power away from the political monarchies, the kings and queens, and transferred the power to the individual citizen. In the same way, we can think of the old established religions as religious monarchies. And what evidence of reincarnation is going to do is transfer power and responsibility from these established religions to the individual. People will realize that they're responsible for their own spiritual growth and for their behavior. What they do, they will have to account for in a future lifetime. And I just see this as really kind of creating a new world. And you know, I believe that in the future, after the evidence of reincarnation is accepted in the consciousness of the masses, they'll look back at the time when we were divided by these religions as the Dark Ages, which they are.
So you view knowledge of reincarnation as being a real positive thing for the world?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to change the world, transform it for the better.
And one of the very interesting things about the research that Ian Stevenson did was the fact that some children have birthmarks and deformities that relate to a previous life.
Yes. You know, actually, as I mentioned, they have over 1,500 of these validated childhood past life memory cases. And from these cases, we can derive what I call principles of reincarnation, in which we understand how reincarnation works, the mechanics of reincarnation. And I describe 10 principles. One is that people can look the same from one lifetime to another. The facial features can be exactly the same. Birthmarks can result from past life wounds. So if an individual was shot, say, in the right shoulder, or let's say the right side of left side of the chest and hits the heart and dies because of that, in the next lifetime, the person can have a birthmark or scar on the left side of the chest mirroring where the past life wound was. People can have phobias related to the cause of past life death. So if somebody was hit by a truck and killed that way in the next lifetime, they may have a fear of big trucks. The other thing that's shown by these cases, which is very profound, is that souls plan lifetimes to be reunited with loved ones. So, and in fact, Stevenson had a collection of 31 sets of twins. So we're talking about 62 people, 62 children, who spontaneously remembered their past lives. And in 100% of these cases, the children had significant past life relationships. So the most common being siblings in a past lifetime, but they could be spouses or other family members. And when you realize that a soul can actually plan the conception for its next lifetime to occur in the life of a loved one. That is amazing what the soul can do and how intelligent the process of reincarnation and soul evolution is. Also, talents and personality traits can persist from one lifetime to another. There are xenoglossy cases where people can speak a language, a past life language, that they had never learned by normal means in their contemporary lifetime. Also, there are cases that show what I call split incarnation, where a soul can animate more than one physical body at a time. And Ian Stevenson called these cases with anomalous dates because the lifetimes overlap. Also, the cases show that people can change gender from one lifetime to another, though this only occurs in 10% of Stevenson's bank of cases. And let me just finish my point. When gender change does occur, then homosexuality can result, because the person, when they reincarnate, still have the mindset of their prior gender.
So I was going to go through the principles of reincarnation. I've got them all listed here. If we could go through them one by one. And the first one I've got in the list is physical resemblance, or something to do with the soul's energy template. Could you tell us about that?
The cases show, and perhaps what I can do is describe a specific case that Stevenson studied involving a little girl named Suzanne Ghanem. And in her past lifetime, her name was Hanan Mansour. And Mansour was born in the 1930s, grew up, had a family, eventually developed heart problems, and had to have surgery. She was born in Lebanon. They couldn't do the surgery there. So she went to Virginia in the United States, where she had a brother living there, and she had the surgery there in Virginia. Prior to the surgery, she told her brother, if anything happens to me and I don't make it, divide my jewelry among my daughters. She also tried to call her daughter Layla prior to surgery, who was in Lebanon, but couldn't get the phone connection to work. She had the surgery, and the next day she died. Only 10 days later, Suzanne was born. And before she was taught to read or write, she scribbled a number on a piece of paper. And it turned out this was the phone number of the Mansour family, with only two digits transposed. She also started to, as a toddler, pull the phone off the hook and ask for Layla. Well, the family didn't know anybody named Layla. And so her parents asked, who's Layla? And Suzanne said, that was my daughter. And they said, what are you talking about? And she said, ask me later when my head is bigger. And in fact, 1 year later, she recalled the names of 13 relatives specifically. She remembered her own name, her husband's name, who is Farouk, gave enough information on where she had lived before. Suzanne, by the way, was born in Lebanon, as was Hanan. Suzanne gave enough information that her family could locate the Mansour family, and Suzanne was able to identify all the relatives of the Mansour family by name, even her husband from the prior lifetime, who was a career policeman who was very skeptical at first, came to believe this little girl is the reincarnation of his dead wife, because he could show her pictures of them at parties and social events, and she could name their friends in these pictures, people that she has had no exposure to in her contemporary lifetime. Well, Stevenson studied Suzanne back in the late 1960s when she was a little girl. Stevenson went back to Lebanon in 1998 to research new cases, but he decided to revisit two cases that he had studied before. One of these involves Suzanne Ghana. Well, you know, 20, 30 years has gone by, and now Suzanne is a full-grown adult. And when you compare the facial features, the photographs of Hannon and Suzanne Ghana, they look exactly the same. And there's a second case that Stevenson studied in Lebanon involving a boy named Daniel Jurdi, who he studied in the early 1970s. And it was very much the same type of case as Suzanne's case. And Stevenson again went back to Lebanon in 1998. About 20 years had transpired since he first studied Daniel. And in 1998, in comparing photographs, again, Daniel looks exactly like he did in his past lifetime. And there are many other cases that show this phenomenon. And one thing I'd like to mention is on our website, which is reincarnationresearch.com, and reincarnation research is one word. What I've done is I have categorized the cases by these principles of reincarnation. So if you go to the homepage, on the left side, you'll see a whole row of these principles, such as physical resemblance. And if you click on the principle, then all the cases that provide proof of the principle appear. Also on the homepage, down towards the bottom, there's a section that is entitled Evidence and Principles of Reincarnation. And it features a picture of Daniel Jurdi holding a photo of his own past life persona. And if you click on that link, it gives a whole overview of reincarnation research, including all these principles we're discussing.
And so when you talk about the soul's energy template, are you suggesting that the soul has a likeness kind of built into it, that it overlays on the fetus in some way when it joins with it?
We don't know scientifically exactly how it works, but my theory is that the soul projects an energy template into the developing fetus, and that the tissue molds around this template. And kind of a similarity is orthopedic surgeons use electric current to heal bad fractures. The bone tissue will align itself with the electric current. And you can think of it in the same way, the energy template of the soul results in facial features being similar from lifetime to lifetime. And in addition, through this energy template, information can be downloaded, such as past life memories, but also talents and abilities.
Is it, I suppose, a case if somebody dies in their previous life in some violent way, that is put onto the template, and that's how come we have the birthmarks in the next life?
Correct. There's two ways you can look at it. One, that the energy template that's in the body can be affected by trauma, and then the template has a mark, if you will, where that trauma occurred, and then that mark reappears in the future incarnation. Ian Stevenson favored a way to think of it that the mind influenced the body. So if the mind, recalls having a wound in a particular place, the mind will create a birthmark or scar in that area. You can think of it either way.
And so if there's a template bringing through a physical resemblance, is there something that would bring through similar intelligence or personalities?
Yeah, exactly. So there are also many cases, and so this is under the category of child prodigies and innate talent. And we have a number of cases where people replicate exactly talent-wise what they did before. For instance, there's a case involving the reincarnation of the artist Paul Gauguin. This is not an Ian Stevenson case. It's an independently researched case where unconsciously Peter Tekamp, who's identified as the reincarnation of Gauguin, unconsciously replicated sketches that Gauguin did that mirrored the development of Gauguin. And these were sketches that Peter himself never saw until after he had done them. Another case that's very important involves the reincarnation of Anne Frank. And this is it involves a woman named Barbara Carlin. And it's essentially an Ian Stevenson type case, but there was no Ian Stevenson to study her when she was a child. Anne Frank died in 1945 in a concentration camp. She was persecuted as a Jew. And then 9 years later, in 1954, Barbara Carlin was born to a Christian family in Sweden. And as soon as she could talk, she told her parents, "My name's not Barbara, it's Anna Frank, and you're not my real parents. My real parents are going to come get me and take me to my real home." Well, her parents, being Christians, you know, didn't know what she was talking about and were even so concerned, they took her to a psychiatrist to be evaluated. But by that time, Barbara was realized, you know, when she would talk about her past life memories, everybody would get so tense. So she didn't tell the psychiatrist anything about her past life memories. And he said, you know, she's fine. But she had full memories of the Frank lifetime, including the attic, arrest in the attic, the German soldiers. In fact, Barbara had a phobia of men in uniform. And she became a child prodigy in writing, just as Anne Frank was. Anne Frank, I point out, was not the most famous victim of the Holocaust because she had the worst death. It was because she was a gifted child writer who wrote about very universal, mature themes like the nature of good and evil, the nature of man. And scholars have been amazed how, you know, this teenager who's, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old could write in such a way. Well, Barbara replicated that development. And she was just writing for herself, just like Anne did. And a family friend looked at what she was writing and said, "Wow, this is really good. It should be published. Do you mind if we take these to a publisher?" And sure enough, her first book of prose was published when she was only 12 years old. The title of the book was Man on Earth, and it became the best-selling prose book in Swedish history. And during her teenage years, she wrote 9 or 10 books that were published and translated in multiple languages. And she became a little celebrity because she would be on TV shows, you know, debating theology with full-grown ministers. So she, again, replicated the talent. And kind of the bottom line is we're the same people from lifetime to lifetime, but the circumstances change. And this case is so important because it dramatically shows that religion and nationality can change. Anne Frank was born in Germany, was persecuted as a Jew, but reincarnated into a Christian family in Sweden. And I make the point that if the Nazis knew you could be Jewish in one lifetime and Christian in another, the Holocaust could not have happened. And in a similar way, when, you know, Muslims and Christians and Jews realized they could reincarnate in contrasting religions from their current lifetime, then people will stop fighting about this.
Did Barbara Carlin have these memories of Anne Frank before the diary was published?
Well, that's actually a very good point. So when I mentioned that Barbara told her parents that she was Anna Frank, her parents had no idea who the historic Anne Frank was, because the diary had not yet been translated, published, and distributed in Sweden. So when she came up with the name Anna Frank, they had no idea who she was, and Barbara herself had no exposure to who Anne Frank was. One thing that helped validate this case in her parents' eyes was that when Barbara was 10 years of age, her parents took her on a vacation to the major cities of Europe, including Amsterdam. The Frank family was from Germany, but when the Nazis took over, they fled to the Netherlands to try to escape the Nazis. But unfortunately, the Nazis later invaded Holland, the Netherlands, and the Frank family hid for 2 years in an attic, but were eventually discovered. Well, by the time Barbara was 10 years of age, the diary of Anne Frank had been translated and published in Sweden, and her parents now knew who the historic Anne Frank was. Well, since they were in Amsterdam, which is where the attic was that the Frank family had hid, the father wanted to go see the Anne Frank House and Museum. And he picked up the phone to get a cab to take them there. And Barbara says, "Oh, we don't need a cab. It's right near here." And her parents said, "How could you know? You've never been here." And she said, "Well, I'll show you." And she took them by the hand and led them on a 10-minute walk through the winding streets of Amsterdam straight to the Anne Frank House. And her parents were stunned, you know, how she did this. And then inside the attic, in the room where Anne Frank had slept, Barbara looked at a particular wall and said, "Look, Mommy, the pictures of the movie stars are still on the wall." And her mother looked at the wall and saw that there was nothing there, you know, and she told Barbara, "Barbara, the wall is bare." And Barbara looked again and realized that was true, got confused and upset. And her mother said, "Well, let's ask the tour guide." And the tour guide said, "Well, yes, normally the pictures that Anne Frank had clipped of movie stars from magazines, she clipped these movie star images and would place them on the wall because they were her heroes and heroines." And but the tour guide said that people were touching them, damaging them, sometimes taking them. So they took all these pictures down. But they planned to put them back up, but under glass, so they're protected. And it was at this moment that her parents realized that she actually was having past life memories of being Anne Frank, rather than these being fantasies. So that was the first time at 10 years of age that she got validation from her parents.
And I believe Barbara met Anne Frank's cousin. How did that go?
Oh, so what happened, like the Ian Stevenson, in most Ian Stevenson cases, children's past life memories start to fade when they're 7, 8, 9 years of age. And the same thing happened with Barbara. And she was actually very relieved that the memories faded because they were very traumatic memories. And life went on, and actually, after her books were published, she got married, had a child, a boy, but unfortunately, her husband cheated on her, and so she divorced him, and now she was a single mother and had to provide for her son, and she had kind of an interesting solution. I mentioned that she had a phobia of men in uniform, such as police. And the other thing is she loved horses and nature. And she thought she could, one, get over her phobia of uniforms as well as work with horses by becoming a Swedish mounted police officer. And that's what she did for 16 years. She was a member of the Swedish National Police Force, and she did end up being a mounted policewoman and trained horses in the end. She, you know, she led a grounded life as a policewoman, and it wasn't until later in life that a traumatic event occurred that re-triggered the memories of being Anne Frank. And so she actually wrote a book about her past life memories entitled And the Wolves Howled. And she did this in about 1995 or so. And her publisher at the time, this was, the publisher of her book was contacted by Bodie Elias, who was the last living relative of Anne Frank. Bodie and Anne had played together as children, and they were lifelong playmates and friends. And Bodie had heard about Barbro's story of being Anne Frank, that her book was coming out, and he wanted to meet her, not because he believed in reincarnation, but simply he wanted to meet this woman who claimed to be the reincarnation of his cousin. Bodie Elias and Anne Frank were cousins. So he asked the publisher to invite, for the publisher and Barbro to come to his house in Switzerland. And he told the publisher, but don't tell her who I am. In other words, don't tell her that I'm Anne Frank's cousin or that I'm the president of the Anne Frank Foundation, which he was. He said, just tell her that I'm a fan of her, the books that she wrote when she was a child. So they came to Bodie's house for dinner, and the publisher tells Anne, why don't you knock on the door? And she thought, well, that's kind of strange, but okay. So she knocks on the door, Bodie opens the door, and Barbro and Bodie had like instant recognition. And they fell into each other's arms and talked for 2 hours straight, and then became lifelong friends. And when Barbro's book did come out, And the Wolves Howled, Bodie even participated in some of her presentations, introducing her, and in that way expressing support for her story. And I mentioned they became lifelong friends. Kind of an interesting anecdote is that there was a Holocaust anniversary during the presidency of George W. Bush, and Bodie Elias, because he was president of the Anne Frank Foundation and the cousin of Anne Frank, you know, he's sort of become the spokesperson for the Holocaust. So the Bushes invited Bodie Elias and his wife to the White House to commemorate the Holocaust. They had dinner there. And then afterwards, Bodie and his wife flew to California, where Barbro was now living, to spend time with her. And they would actually stay at Barbro's house. And after this White House dinner, Bodie's wife said to Barbro, well, you know, the reason that we're getting this rock star treatment is because of you. You know, you're actually Anne Frank, but we get to get the public accolades. And similarly, whenever Barbro went to Europe, she would visit Bodie and stay at his home. So it's another example of how people can be reunited through reincarnation.
Before you were reborn, there's a point where you would need to choose what your life is going to be. And you have a life plan and it's worked out, but is that life plan set in stone and that you don't really have any free will to go away from it?
Well, my analysis of this, what I do is I use the analogy of a prolonged vacation. Let's say you live in the United States and you're going to take a 6-month trip to explore Europe, and you've got family and friends in different parts of Europe. So you set up an itinerary that, okay, I'm going to fly to England on this day. I'm going to visit these relatives, stay for 2-3 weeks. Then I'm going to go to France, visit these relatives. Then you could have a business partner in another country. So you go visit your business partner and you work together on a project. So I think the way that life works is just like you have a plan or an itinerary for your extended vacation, you have a plan or a predestined path that you're going to take in life, where you meet up with people you've known before, which may be based on love or that you've got karma you have to work out with. You may meet up with people in your plan with whom you're going to have a project to do and so forth. But just like on the vacation, though you have set a predetermined itinerary, which most people follow because that's why they made the plan, you still have free will in how you behave and what you do along the way. So it's a combination of having a predestined plan, yet at the same time, having free will on what you do and how you behave.
And before your birth, when you putting together this life plan, how do you know what you would need to do in that life? What sort of, do you have guides that would say to you, right, in this next life, we think you need to do this?
Yes. And another part of the work that I do is since the year 2001, I've worked with Kevin Ryerson, who's a well-known trance medium. He's the trance medium who's worked with Shirley MacLaine for over 40 years. He's featured in 4 of her books, including Out on a Limb. And in the movie version of Out in a Limb, Kevin actually plays himself. And as a trance medium, what he does is he goes into a meditative state and he allows spirits to take over his body so that these spirits can communicate with human beings. And Kevin does not have any memory of what happens during the sessions when the spirits take over. And when a spirit takes over his body, the voice changes, facial expressions change, personality changes, sense of humor changes. There is like a totally different person sitting in front of you. And I've been working with a particular spirit guide named Atun Ray, who was last incarnate on Earth about 3,500 years ago in ancient Egypt. And since then, he sort of has been monitoring life on Earth from the spiritual planes. And he's working through Kevin as a service to humanity. And so what in my work with Atun Ray, one of the main reasons I started working with him is I was looking for a psychic or medium who could help me sort out reincarnation cases. I mean, some cases are rock solid, like the Ian Stevenson cases, they're rock solid. They stand on their own. But sometimes people approach me, like I mentioned the Paul Gauguin case, and I'm not entirely sure if the case is valid or not. And so I was looking for somebody who can help me sort this out. And, you know, I've worked with Kevin since 2001, pretty much on a monthly basis. And Atun Ray demonstrated to me that he can make accurate past life matches. So Once I realized I had this highly, and I should mention Atun Ray is the most intelligent being, living or deceased, that I've ever interacted with. And once I realized I had this connection with a genuine, intelligent spirit, you know, I would ask the bigger picture questions, like when were souls created? Do we have a life plan like what we were discussing? And so insights into these matters have come through the realm of spirit, through Atun Re. And Atun Re says, yes, that indeed we have spirit guides that help us figure out what we need to do in a future incarnation to spiritually evolve. And, you know, the long-term goal is to evolve to the point where you don't have to reincarnate. Atun Re, for instance, loves his existence in the spirit world. I once asked him, well, what's your state of being like up there? And he said, lucid ecstasy. And so you can see why he might not want to reincarnate, because, you know, living on Earth is not always lucid ecstasy. But Atun Re does say that we have spirit guides who help us understand what we need to do. And in fact, Atun Re has confirmed that Kevin, I, and Atun Re agreed to work together before Kevin or I were ever born. And it's kind of a team where we each have a unique ability. Atun Re has the ability to read the what people call the Akashic Records, or you could call it universal mind, where he can derive past life identities. And Kevin is probably the most gifted trance medium in the whole world. You know, I can't do mediumship, and Kevin can't do past life identifications like Atun Re. And I'm basically the scribe, where, you know, I all the sessions with Atun Re are based on questions. He doesn't just spew out information. It's all based on free will, really, where I have to come up with questions that he can respond to. So my job is to ask the questions. His job is to give me the answers. And then I take that information and put it in usable form, such as my books. One of my books about focusing on evidence of reincarnation is called Born Again. And then a book I wrote about these bigger picture questions is called Origin of the Soul and the Purpose of Reincarnation. And Origin of Soul is based on my dialogues with Atun Re.
And so when you asked him about where do souls come from, what did he say?
Well, what he said is that a nanosecond after the Big Bang, all souls were created at once. So, you know, many times people ask about how can reincarnation be true if the population is expanding? You know, there's a question, are new souls being created, or how does it work? Well, according to Atun Re, there were a finite number of souls that were created all at once, just after the universe was created, just after the Big Bang. And then we've been reincarnating over time to develop. I make the point that you know, part of the reason for incarnation is to just establish a unique identity. I point out that think of what your identity would be like if you had no memories. You know, if you were a blank slate and had no memories prior to this moment, well, you would not have an identity, because your identity is based on your experiences. So part of the reason we incarnate is to, you know, establish an identity. And also, when we're created as souls, we are created with what I call a specific energy spectrum, a certain set of energies, or which then translate into talents and abilities. So, for instance, what we see in cases is artists reincarnate as artists, musicians reincarnate as musicians, writers reincarnate as writers. And so part of incarnation is to develop our God-given talents or abilities. And the answer to the growing population, how can that be if there's a finite number of souls, is simply, the simplest answer is frequency of incarnation. So when the human population on Earth was much smaller, a soul could perhaps incarnate maybe once in 1,000 years. Whereas now, when there are billions of human bodies, souls can reincarnate continually, which is what we see.
And is there any information about souls incarnating elsewhere on other planets?
Well, that theoretically does happen. I mean, I've asked Hatun Ray about that, and he says, yes, that happens. But, you know, my focus is really trying to get human beings on this planet to understand that we reincarnate. And, you know, incarnation on another planet is going to be very difficult to prove, at least at this point in time.
So another one of the principles of reincarnation is to do with deja vu.
Right. So experiences of deja vu can be due to various types of past life memories, which are unconscious. So let's say you had your last lifetime was in Greece, and now you're born in the United States. You may take a trip to Greece and experience deja vu because the surroundings feel so familiar. And actually, another principle of reincarnation that I describe is called geographic memory, where people innately know the geography of a place that they've never been to before. And oftentimes, that knowledge is accompanied with the deja vu feeling, and that's based on past life experience. Or another reason is that deja vu can occur by an unconscious realization that you've met a past life colleague. It's the same phenomenon of love at first sight. Like I said, we have a predetermined destiny, which includes relationships that we need to have. So let's say you have a very bad relationship in a past lifetime with somebody. Well, the way that you can equalize that in a future lifetime is to actually marry that person. Well, you know, when you incarnate, you don't remember your pre-birth planning. And so you go through life pretty much, you know, winging it. And then when you meet the person that you're supposed to have the relationship with, you can have this feeling like, oh my God, I know this person, or have a deja vu experience and have love at first sight because you're supposed to fall in love with this person, but all this is unconscious.
So do we have such a thing as a soulmate or a soul twin that we would always have a relationship with in every life?
That's a complicated question. And I do address it in Origin the Soul, but the way Atun Ray explains it is that when souls were created, they were created as pairs. Two souls basically that are complementary. I kind of think of it like the poles of a battery. Each battery has a positive side and a negative side. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way, just, you know, in terms of physics, there are polarities. And these souls that were created are not the kind of souls that fall in love from one lifetime to another. They're there to sort of create balance. So supposedly Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush were these kinds of soulmates, or what I call dipoles. They're both souls who are kind of militaristic in nature, but they incarnate on opposite sides of the world and actually engage in conflict. And there you can maybe see the principle that these two dipoles balance each other out, though it's not a pretty thing. Another set of dipoles that's much more fun is that Laurel and Hardy were these kinds of soulmates, where they were both, they're both comedians, but they're contrasting. You know, Ollie was fat, chubby, a Mr. Know-It-All, where Stan was thin and kind of helpless. They're both comedians, but they're contrasting, but their contrast actually provides the chemistry that makes them so funny. In terms of people getting together romantically from lifetime to lifetime, that's more the issue that as we go through our incarnations, we meet up with people that we just resonate with, that we find, oh, wow, we get along really well. And so as long as your karma permits it, you can plan to be together from one lifetime to another because you find that you're like best friends. But the romantic type soulmates are not the kind that are created as complementary pairs.
I'm a member of some reincarnation groups on Facebook where there's all sorts of discussions going on. And one question that pops up quite often is, why don't we remember our past lives? Do you have an idea of what the purpose is of why we have to forget?
Well, I think it's there's again a couple different ways to understand it. A more esoteric way that Atun Ray explains it is that we as souls, as we started to incarnate, our consciousnesses started to just get too deeply ingrained in the physical body. And sort of the spiritual connection or the connection with the spirit world was lost. But on a practical side, it probably is better that way because otherwise you can't have a fresh start. You know, if somebody killed you in a past lifetime and you remember that, when you reincarnate, you may have the urge to kill that person back, you know? Whereas the way the spirit world works is if you killed somebody in a future lifetime, you would be brought back together with that person, but you may be born as brothers or close friends so that you have the opportunity to learn about the other person. You're able to love that person rather than hate that person. But if you remember everything, you couldn't really have that fresh start. Also, there's kind of the argument that if you remembered all your lives, you know, it would be just too difficult to focus on your contemporary life.
So do you have any past life memories?
You know, I actually don't. I mean, I wish I did. And I used to be on the board of directors of a regression organization, and I've had past life regressions done, but I'm just a bad candidate. And it seems like some people do well in regression and some people don't. I don't have easy access to past life memories, but I do know about quite a few past lifetimes, you know, based on my work with Kevin and Atun Ray.
What I find with past life regression is the more you do it, the better you get at it. There's a kind of practice, but also there's a thing where your soul guides may decide for you that it's not the best thing to do at that point in your life.
Yeah, that's very possible. I mean, my rationalization is I'm just very left brain. You know, my entire training is in science. I'm a medical doctor. And I think my left brain keeps getting in the way. You know, if a past life memory even tries to pop up, I start rationalizing it. So actually, I asked that about Atun Ray. Why? Because I definitely have had telepathic experiences where information was transmitted to me from the outside. It felt like it was coming from outside me, and the information turned out to be correct. So, I mean, I have had psychic experiences. I have experienced telepathy. And I asked, and I, you know, I even took a psychic development course over a period of a year and a half, and I felt like the worst student in the class. And I asked Dr. Dre, you know, because that's frustrating. I would like to be able to do that. And I asked Dr. Dre, why aren't I more psychic or able to tap into more information from a psychic point of view? And Atun Ray said, because remember I told you the division of labor, that Atun Ray is the one who can read the Akashic records. Kevin is the trance medium. My job in this lifetime was to be the rational scientist who would put this information together in a cohesive manner. And Atun Ray pointed out that there have been many mediums and psychics over time, but very few of them have been able to actually create a logical working system. Of course, you know, you could say that all the founders of the major religions were psychic in one way or another, but unfortunately, you know, their different doctrines have led to a lot of conflict. So apparently my destiny was to be kind of a left brain, logical, scientific person, so I could take the information gained through Atun Ray via Kevin into comprehensible form. And I have to say, I think that that is being done. Ian Stevenson provided a great deal of evidence, but he didn't tie it together into a comprehensive understanding of how reincarnation works, where I think through my work with Kevin and Atun Ray, as well as utilizing the data from Ian Stevenson, we have come up with a quite comprehensive understanding of how reincarnation and soul evolution works.
And is one of your books that kind of description?
Yeah, so the two main books that I promote at this time are called, one is called Born Again. And if you just, you know, Born Again is a Christian term, but if you put my name, Semkiw, S-E-M-K-I-W, and Born Again, or just even Born Again Reincarnation, it'll pop up. And then the second book I promote, which is my dialogues with Atun Ray about the bigger picture issues, such as the issue of soulmates, that's called Origin of the Soul and the Purpose of Reincarnation.
People can get those books on Amazon, is that right?
Yes, and in fact, I just converted to the Amazon print-on-demand system, so my books are now available worldwide through Amazon.com.
Are they on Kindle as well?
Yes, and also, you know, if people don't want to purchase the books, reincarnationresearch.com is a very comprehensive resource on reincarnation research.
Yeah, I found it to be a fantastic site. There's so much information there.
Thank you. I mean, I used to do live presentations, but I stopped because now the internet is a much more effective way to go. Oh, and I should mention also, I put up a video on YouTube entitled Evidence of Reincarnation. And now it's got 6.2 million views, and it's less than 10 minutes long, but it focuses on the work of Ian Stevenson. It features the Anne Frank case, and it also features the most important American case, which involves a person named James Leininger.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite cases. That's from Jim Tucker, isn't it?
Actually, the case was researched by James Leininger's father, Bruce Leininger, and they published a book called Soul Survivor. Tucker actually had nothing to do with researching the case, but later on he did a little summary of the case in one of his books.
Thank you very much for coming on to the podcast. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you so much.
And that was an interview with Walter Simkew. My book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. It sold nearly 3,000 copies, and I'm getting great feedback. And my new website is simonbound.com. That's Bound, not Brown. It replaces the Past Lives Hypnosis website, and you can go to that website for past life regression, as well as info on my books and podcasts. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.